It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Ukraine is reportedly preparing a counteroffensive to push Russian invaders back. We'll talk to an armed conflict international relations expert about the strategy and the U.S.'s role in it. First, U.S. Drought Monitor says nearly all of southern Wisconsin's under abnormally dry conditions right now, and the National Weather Service says the area is facing elevated fire conditions due to the dry air and gusting winds. What's our summer weather looking like? When will we see some substantial rain? And will it be enough to come to the relief of crops across our state? We'd like you to join this conversation, especially if you are a farmer or involved in agriculture, and let us know what you are seeing early in this growing season. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us ideas@wpr.org. Joining us is Tim Halbach, a warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. And Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Also our guest this afternoon, Jerry Clark. He's the UW Extension crop and soil educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. Jerry, welcome back to you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Lee.
Tim, I'm going to start with you and look at our weather. The U.S. Drought Index says we're roughly two-thirds of Wisconsin's under some abnormally dry weather conditions right now. What is that looking like to from where your perspective, and what do you expect to see going forward?
Yeah, a lot of this has all happened within the last month or two across Wisconsin. The southern part of the state, it's been more so a two-month thing where mid-April, it seemed like the rain just shut off, or any of the precipitation that we had going for us just ended. We started getting a lot more of these high-pressure systems coming in from the northeast and from southeastern Canada, which is, it's made for nice conditions if you're not a farmer or somebody like that, but it's led to some fairly dry conditions. So in the southern part of the state, it's been a little bit more pronounced to begin with. We're about 4 to 6 inches of precipitation below normal for the last 2 months. The northern part of the state, it's a little bit less, but some of that was just from the later part of April where they were able to keep things there. So you know, with the dry conditions, we start providing feedback to the drought monitor to let them know, you know, here's what we're hearing. These are what some of the rivers are doing. It's not just how much precipitation deficit we're seeing, but everything kind of put together. So that's where it's been beneficial to hear things from farmers, you know, things like, you know, the irrigation ditch that I normally use to pull water from starting to run out of water. That's the kind of stuff that we need to hear about so that we can let the drought monitor folks say, you know, hey, things are maybe a little bit worse than what we're saying here.
And Tim, how do weather conditions, and for that matter, our irrigation at this point, our rivers and streams, how do they look compared to previous years? And are we seeing trends and changes to our weather conditions this time of year?
So coming out of winter, the rivers were actually pretty high up because we had a pretty good period of precipitation to start the year, to the point where the drought from last year was erased and we had no more drought conditions, at least through the drought monitor. And the rivers were pretty decent. And actually, you know, for a period we had flood warnings. Mississippi was at record levels. Mm-hmm. And that all kind of ended when we got to April. So you know, what we've been seeing is just this, you know, this change that's happened now. So with the precipitation falling off and not really getting these good periods of rainfall where this time of year we're expecting an inch of rain a week, that's leading to these drying conditions, you know, happening a lot faster.
And so Tim Halbach joining us from the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, also our guest Jerry Clark from the UW Extension. And Jerry, I'd ask you, I mean, we did see some rain earlier this spring, but it has seemed to dry out, particularly in southern Wisconsin. And what does this mean for farmers across the state?
Yeah, we had a good planting season, a little bit behind early on, but then with this dry spell that's been in northern Wisconsin here for at least 3 to 4 weeks now, this is where we're starting to see the effect of that dry weather, and the planting season got caught up. So emergence was pretty good for the crops that were spring planted. Your small grains, alfalfa, corn, soybeans, seemed like they came out of the ground pretty well. and we had a nice start to the year. And now, even though we're early, we can start to have a little concern simply because we've got dry conditions, especially on those lighter soils where they're a little bit more sandy. Even those fields may be irrigated and have potential for irrigation. Even the heavier soils that we see across a lot of the dairy belt in Wisconsin had a nice crop of alfalfa, at least an average crop. But now, what's the future going to hold to get that second crop going? So right now, the crop I think is under some moderate stress. We're not in a critical period yet because the crop is a little younger, a little smaller in terms of the grains. But that alfalfa and hay crop is the one we could be getting concerned about simply because there's no soil moisture to get that second crop up and running.
And Jerry, what does the drier conditions mean for some of the herbicides that are used by farmers?
Yeah, it's a good question, Lee. It's one that we kind of forget about that, we need moisture to activate those herbicides. So they can be put on the fields we call them a pre-emergence herbicide, where they're put on before the weeds emerge, but they need water to activate. And so without the rainfall, the efficacy of these herbicides after a few days or about a week to 10 days, they can start to lose that efficacy. And you need a good rain to kind of move those herbicides down into the soil profile a couple inches where they can do most of their work to prevent those weeds from emerging. So that's where we've had a concern early, is that we were so dry right after the corn planting season that many of these herbicides may lose their efficacy simply because they don't have the moisture to activate. And that's where we've seen the irrigation systems, especially in Dunn and Chippewa County, being run early. It wasn't because of the crop needing moisture, although that's helpful. It was more to get those herbicides activated so the weed control can be there throughout the season.
Jerry Clark, UW Extension Crops and Soils Educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire Counties. Also joining us, Tim Halbach, who is the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. We invite you to the conversation with your questions for our experts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or your observations on what you've seen so far in this spring weather and what you might expect come summer. Tim, what will the effects be on the state if these dry conditions continue? What could we see?
So that's something that we've been looking at quite a bit now, is trying to see, are there any big rainfalls coming down the pipeline? And at the moment, we're not seeing a whole lot of that. So when we're trying to look at a week or two out, we maybe have something this Saturday that comes through. It's the heaviest rainfall right now is going to be painted across the central part of the state. And then going through the following week after that, there's not a whole lot. So the other things we start to look for as well is heat. If we have any big heat waves, that can make things go faster in terms of the drought and just some of the conditions that we're seeing. And thankfully, we're not looking at 90 to 100 degree temperatures or anything like that over the next few weeks. But if we continue on these dry periods where we have week after week where we're not getting that half inch to an inch or more of precipitation, that's just going to set the stage for July when our temperatures peak from basically the whole month is anytime that we can get some of those big heat waves. So those are some of the things that we're keeping an eye on as we go through this time frame.
Jerry Clark, what's the rule of thumb here? Where's our corn supposed to be by the 4th of July, up to our waist or somewhere around there? And so when you hear the forecast from Tim in the weeks to come, what's that sound like to a farmer in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a little concerning since there's a longer dry spell, maybe not hot. And again, that's one thing. The temperature will drive a lot of that evapotranspiration, we call it, what's pulled out of the ground versus what the crop uses. Also, in addition to what evaporation occurs. But I think this longer term dry spell, I think right now is where the corn crop will use, about a tenth of an inch. It's younger. If we're looking at corn and soybeans, it's a little younger. It'll pull out maybe a tenth to a tenth of an inch of precipitation or water each day. So as we pull, 10 days worth of water out, that's an inch of rain that needs to be replaced. And if we don't get that, that's when we continue to see the stress. So there are, as long as it's cooler, that'll help, but we still have a dry soil condition, and that's not going to get any better. So that evapotranspiration that occurs as the crop pulls out water plus what it loses in evaporation, we need to replace that. And if these spotty rains that occur, yeah, if you're the farmer that happens to catch that half inch to 1 inch rain that might be coming through, that's good news, but your neighbor may miss that. And so what we kind of need right now is that overall kind of drenching rain, nice and slow, for over a couple days. That'll add an inch or two to our soil moisture. So I think as a farmer out there, that's the concern, is that as this continues along, especially dairy farmers, where they're really going to rely on maybe that alfalfa crop or a hay crop to continue to have feedstuff for winter, we're going to probably see that those successive crops, especially that second and third cutting, if this occurs, continues, that there's going to be high feed prices, along with just no a lack of feed out there in general.
Ooh, UW Extension crops and soils educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties, Jerry Clark, joining us, along with a warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service, Milwaukee, Tim Halbach, also our guest. And we invite you to this conversation about our upcoming summer weather, our forecast, and our fall harvest. What do you see out there? And if you're a farmer, we'd love you to join our conversation as well at any time. 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue our conversation next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our conversation on the abnormally dry weather around Wisconsin we've seen so far, at least in the latest weeks of spring, and what that may portend for summer as well as our fall harvest. Our guest, Tim Halbach, warning coordination meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, and Jerry Clark, UW Extension crops and soils educator for Chippewa, Dunn, and Eau Claire counties. We invite you to our conversation as well. How does it feel Wisconsin weather is changing? How do you feel Wisconsin weather's changing over your time here? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where Mark in Richland Center standing by. Mark, good afternoon. Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, good afternoon. What are you seeing where you are?
We're just running into dry weather like you were talking about, and we've missed all the little pop-up showers here for our farm. So we're struggling, I would say. Some of the pastures are starting to get pretty brown, and we graze our cows, so we need the pasture out there. Plus, it's been good for getting crops in because we're ahead of schedule a little bit, but there's not going to be much of a second cutting.
And what can you do as a dairy farmer, Mark, to try to mitigate some of this drier weather? Is there any steps you can take above and beyond praying for rain?
Sometimes we put some corn on hay ground after we take the first cutting off, and we actually bought some sorghum sedan grass that we're going to plant instead of the corn, which is going to be a good solution maybe for August or so. We'll graze the cows on that to try to get some forage for them, but it's going to hurt over the winter just because we'll be not having that corn to feed. Over the winter, we'll have to buy some corn instead of having that feed. So hopefully we can get through it. And where some of the cows, we've kind of set up a cull program where we cull a couple of the extra cows, maybe that aren't as quite as good, just so we can get the cow numbers down so we have enough feed.
Yeah. Mark, I appreciate you sharing your story. I wish the very best for you and your farm. And, we are all counting on you, needless to say. And Jerry Clark, when you hear the story of Mark in Richland Center and his dairy farm there, what does this mean? What do you hear about what to expect for the rest of this summer and what we can do besides pray for rain?
Yeah, those are what Mark mentioned. Those are some great strategies that you have to, start planning ahead depending on how long dry spells occur. And, managing that feed inventory and livestock, that's a big part of it. We kind of know as an estimate, farmers have a great feel for average yields and what they need for feed for the year to get their cattle and livestock through the winter. And these strategies where, yeah, you may have to reduce numbers, sometimes purchasing feed, emergency forages are a major part of it. So depending how long this lasts or what happens, you know, over the next, especially the next month to 6 weeks when we know what the corn pollination period looks like and those kind of things, emergency forages sometimes come into play where we, like Mark said, sorghum, sedan grass, we look at some of the small grains. Some people will start to look at buying the neighbor's soybean field for maybe, or some soybean acres to chop for forage and feed. So there's all kinds of alternatives that will start to go into play or some planning the longer that this dry spell continues. So farmers are always on top of things as far as planning ahead and knowing what they need. And Mark's a great example of some of those alternative strategies.
Yeah, Mark, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. And Tim, I'll ask you our forecasts have become so good that we don't expect the weatherman to be wrong very often anymore. And you've taken us out a few weeks, but can you take us our weather out any further than that for Wisconsin and give us some perspective on what we might expect this summer? Or is that too much to ask with the models that we have right now?
Yes. While we were at break, I was trying to look at some of the models that we use that show the trends in the longer term period. They're less reliable. You can maybe start to nail down trends, but being able to pick out, you know, what area is going to get hit for, you know, thunderstorms and things like that is really difficult for the summertime. So I'm not going to go out on a limb and say, you know, get hopes up one way or another. But, you know, the next 2 weeks, the models have gotten pretty good that we can at least see those kind of trends. And right now it's looking like the weekends, the next 2 weekends. So this one Saturday, there's a cold front that comes down and then it looks dry most of next week. And then maybe another stronger storm system for the following weekend. But, you know, whether that's a line of thunderstorms that gives you an inch of rain in an hour, or, you know, it's not going to be one of those long drawn out rains, but just like anything with the forecast, the closer you get to when that event's going to occur, the more accurate that's going to be. Right now it's, you know, the further out in time you go, the more error shows up in those forecast models, but at least the general trends we can start to get down. So.
And Jerry Clark, if our soil gets so dry, is there a chance we could risk some flooding for farmers once the rain finally does come this summer?
Yeah, absolutely. Like Tim said, I think if we get those, you know, intense thunderstorms that kind of blow through in an hour or two and really don't soak the soil, that's where we can have those flooding events. I think most of that water will move off. The ground gets so hard and the infiltration just doesn't occur very quickly once those soil particles tend to get a little closer together, dry up. It takes a little bit more soaking in order for that infiltration to occur. So we can get an inch of rain, but does that mean an inch went into the soil? Probably not when it comes that quickly. So that's where we do need those, you know, I guess Tim knows better than I, the low pressure system that kind of hangs around for a couple days and just kind of drop some slow, easy rain over several days is kind of what we're back into. It's kind of hard to believe since we had a flooding, especially in Chippewa Falls area here in Chippewa County, we had flooding 6 weeks ago right downtown, and now we're talking about dry weather and a drought.
Those sorts of extremes, Tim, is that something we're likely to see more of with weather patterns in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, so right now you're seeing what the situation is. It's been a blocking high pressure system is what's basically been controlling our weather pattern for the last month or so. So that's why we've had all these cold fronts coming from the northeast, as opposed to your standard, you know, you get the warm air and then the cold front comes through and then it gets cold behind it. This also, you know, with the weather pattern, the way it's been, the fire weather, I know we're not onto that as much with the farmers, but fire weather has become a bit of a concern. There's been a lot of wildfires in southeastern Canada, which normally we get them up in the western or northern part of Canada. But lately, with this flow that we've been in, we've been getting the smoke and everything coming down into Wisconsin. And if you've seen anything on the East Coast, the New York area has been really hit hard with some of the smoke that's come from that. So that's another thing that we're keeping an eye on with just the fuels. If we do get a windy, dry, hot day, that we could have some elevated fire risk going through the next few weeks here too. So it's more so, just to answer your question, the weather pattern we're in with the, you know, what we're in right now, and, you know, whether you see more of those in the future, that's, you know, part of, you know, with the climate change, the difference, you know, climate shifting northward, maybe we're a little bit more into the ridges a little bit more often, but this is kind of a unique pattern that we've been in lately.
So that's somewhat reassuring, I suppose. And Jerry Clark, we've got about a minute left here, but what can we expect for the rest of the summer for our farmers, and what more can they do to protect their crops and protect their herds before we get to a fall harvest and get through the growing season?
Yeah, I think some of that management comes into play as this plays itself out. That's where more decisions will be made regarding if they need to go with emergency forages or try to replant some of the, you know, later on. If we need forage, still corn planted into July still produces more tons of dry matter than some of the emergency forages. So the ability to plant corn late is still there if this is continuing. But if the soil is dry, then you probably want to save the money and maybe have to put it towards feed or purchasing, especially if you're a livestock or dairy owner.
So without some real rain here in the future, farmers might be faced with some real tough decisions going forward.
Absolutely.
Hey, Jerry Clark, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Tim Halbach, thanks to you.
Yeah, no problem.
Jerry is the UW Extension Crops and Soils Educator for Chippewa and Dunn and Eau Claire Counties. Tim Halbach, the Warning Coordination Meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. And we've been taking a look at what we can expect from the growing season, our fall harvest, and what our farmers need from our weather going forward. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a Wisconsin political science professor and armed conflict expert about the war in Ukraine and a potential counteroffensive to push Russia back. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at the historic gains for low-income workers during the pandemic and why the current fight against inflation may reverse those gains. But now, military officials say Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive against the Russian invasion. Some are speculating that it may have already started. President Volodymyr Zelensky has not announced the launch of a formal campaign to push back Russia's front line, but reports say Ukrainian commanders are shifting to offensive actions and sending in some heavy machinery to eastern regions of the country. Still, Ukraine has not committed its main forces to the battle, as reported, raising questions about the country's current military strategy and its strengths. All of this comes as a major dam in southern Ukraine collapsed yesterday, and both sides of the conflict are blaming each other for its destruction and the people's lives who are now in peril because of it. We want to hear what you think at 1-800-642-1234. Let us know about your opinion on the current situation in Ukraine and Russia's involvement in it. Do you think it's time for Ukraine to launch its counteroffensive? And what role should the U.S. be playing, if any? 1-800-642-1234 to join us. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Kidd is a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. And Andy, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, and let's start with the Kakhovka Dam in Kherson, and that the lives that are now, you've got people reportedly on roofs asking to be rescued, and finger pointing going both ways. From afar, from all the way back here in the United States, how are you to make sense, how can we best make sense of this ongoing human tragedy that's happening right now?
Well, I guess there's a couple of ways to approach it. One is the question of who did it, and then there's the question of what the effects are going to be. I think it's overwhelmingly likely that the Russians are the one who blew up the dam, both from a sort of technical perspective, and that it would have been much easier for them to do it because they were in control of the dam physically at the time, and also in terms of motivation to do it. We're seeing the first steps of this long-awaited offensive on the Ukrainian side, And it seems fairly likely that the Russians planned this demolition of the dam as a both response to that in terms of saying, well, we can inflict casualties on you if you keep on attacking us, and also to try to divert resources from the war effort towards this humanitarian relief effort that's going to have to follow in the result of the dam being blown up and the flooding that's happening downstream.
Yeah, so as we look at that, what's happening right now there, the other story that's popped up recently is the U.S. intelligence getting a heads up on the Nord Stream pipeline and a plan that the Ukrainians had to blow up this pipeline last year. But the president, Vladimir Zelensky, has said today that Ukraine was not behind the series of underwater explosions that crippled the Nord Stream gas pipelines in September. How do we begin to make sense of something like that?
Yeah, that's an interesting comparison. I've thought about that a little bit recently as well. It never made a lot of sense that the Russians would blow up their own pipeline. So I was actually somewhat skeptical that it was Russia behind it when that blew up. And I thought it was fairly difficult or unlikely that the Ukrainians did it simply for logistical reasons. But as you say, leaks that came out through this Discord leak that surfaced recently indicate that the Ukrainians at least had a plan to do it, which has a certain resemblance to the events as they actually unfolded. So that certainly raises your sort of estimate of the likelihood that it was Ukraine that did it. I always thought it might be someone more local to the scene who was also hostile to Russia, one of the Baltic states, for instance, that might have done it. But it's certainly possible that it was Ukrainian saboteurs who did that. I think that's a bit different from this case, though, in terms of the main downside or risk for the Ukrainians in attacking the Nord Stream would be if it was discovered and proved that they had done it, then that would have, you know, made the Europeans and particularly the Germans mad at them and jeopardized their support. Whereas in this case, in the case of the Kharkovka Dam, you're talking about, hundreds of square miles of territory that's been inundated. Tens of thousands of people who have to evacuate their homes. Their homes are going to be have to be destroyed in the end. Lives will be lost. Croplands won't be irrigated. So the cost on the Ukrainian side is enormous. And it's not clear what the benefit would be in terms of advantaging the Ukrainian side. So I think it's just extremely unlikely that the Ukrainians did it in this case.
The dam that was holding back the Dnipro River in Ukraine, Kherson, there also was involved in keeping a cooling pool, as I understand it, for the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. Is there reason to be concerned about the future of that power plant as you see it, Andrew?
Well, there's going to be reason to be concerned about that as long as it's in Russian hands. In terms of the immediate short-term future, there isn't. There's somewhat more reason, but not enormous reason. In the sense that they have a cooling pond that is still intact for the power plant itself, which they can draw upon to cool the plant for the foreseeable future in terms of, you know, months looking ahead. So that there's no immediate risk of a meltdown or anything serious like that. And they've shut down much of the plant, so the need for cooling waters has been reduced considerably. So in the short term, we're not worried about that, you know, barring any further Russian activity to sabotage or blow up or disable the plant in some way. There is a possibility, of course, that as part of this summer offensive, that there's going to be fighting in that region, the region of the power plant. It's upstream of that dam that was just blown up, and it's on the path, essentially, from the Ukrainian-Russian front lines as they exist today to the Black Sea or the Azov Sea coast that the Ukrainians might be hoping to eventually reach in order to try to cut off Russian access to Crimea and all the forces to the west of that point. And so it might see further fighting in the future or at least be, you know, in the vicinity of fighting.
Andy Kidd, our guest, political science professor at UW-Madison, taking a look at the Russian war in Ukraine 15 months in. And what are the international rules about things like blowing up dams or blowing up pipelines? And is it rules be damned when it comes to wars like these, Andy?
Well, rules be damned is sort of a good pun in this case. So in the past, you know, dams were blown up in wars in World War II. The dam across further upstream on the Dnieper River was blown up by the Russians when the Germans were coming in. And then the Germans repaired it a little bit and then blew it up again on their way out in 1943. So, and of course, there was the famous raid by British bombers on German dams in the Ruhr Valley. So that's happened in the past. However, that's now been deemed to be, you know, contravention to the laws of war as they were codified in about 1949. So blowing up big civilian infrastructure projects like dams is now deemed to be against the laws of war. So that and that's been pointed out and means that the people who did this may face a liability if Russia loses the war and if they are eventually turned in or become subject to international prosecution. The pipeline is an interesting case. That might be another, I'm not sure if that would qualify in the sense, because you're not targeting civilian lives directly. It's a pipeline at the bottom of the ocean. There's environmental consequences, of course, in terms of pollution. So whether that would qualify as a violation of the laws of war is something I'm not as certain about that as the case of the dams.
Andy, how are we to assess whether or not the counteroffensive from Ukraine has even begun against Russian forces? Russian Defense Ministry said a couple days ago it had already thwarted a major Ukrainian attack in the Donetsk region, killing 300 troops and destroying 16 tanks, but that has not been verified. How do we go about figuring out what's actually happening through this fog of war?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is a transition from the defensive phase of the war, more or less static along most of the front, with some defensive operations around Bakhmut, which gradually fell to the Russians, culminating last month in May, to a phase where the Ukrainians are going to be on the offensive. And you're seeing that in various locations along the front. Interestingly, a lot of the sources that were very forthcoming with where the Russians are attacking are not quite as forthcoming when it comes to where the Ukrainians are attacking. Essentially because they're sort of heeding Ukrainian pleas for operational security and, you know, secrecy about where their forces are moving. But I think what we're seeing is sort of the overture, if you will, of the summer offensive, the spring or summer offensive, depending on how you want to think of it now. That is, the Ukrainians are attacking here and there, looking for weak points, trying to fake the Russians out. They don't want to just attack in a huge manner at one particular location that put all their eggs in that basket. They probably have very good intelligence about where Russian forces are, but they, you know, by attacking here and there, they can keep the Russians off balance and look for a point where the Russians may be weaker than they would be somewhere else, and try to draw Russian forces away from whatever their main axis of advance is going to be, or attempted axis of advance is going to be. And they face the issue that everybody sort of knows, that it would be extremely advantageous for the Ukrainians to, as I mentioned, strike south to the Sea of Azov and cut the Russian forces off. And so that overall strategic objective seems pretty clear. And there's only a sort of limited number of axes you can take to get there. So the Russians can pretty easily sort of anticipate that. But you know, there's enough leeway there to try to fake the Russians out about exactly where you're going to go and what routes you're going to take, and so they're probably trying to play that game now and lure the Russians off balance and get them where they would not be in the way.
We're talking with UW-Madison political science professor Andy Kidd about a upcoming counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia's invasion, and you can join with your questions. Do you support a counteroffensive from Ukraine against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. How much should the U.S. be involved as you see it? And what questions do you have about where things stand in Ukraine right now and what we can expect going forward? Ask our expert. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Andy Kidd. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison who researches armed conflict as well as international relations, and he's with us to discuss the latest on Russia's war in Ukraine and a potential counteroffensive against the invasion. You can join us. What questions do you have about Ukraine's military strategy here, and how much involvement do you think the U.S. should have in supporting the fight back against Russia? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. And Andy, how significant are the U.S. and NATO interests in the success or failure of the counteroffensive, and what is the investment of U.S. and NATO right now and going forward?
Well, I think our interests are pretty significant in the success of Ukraine's effort to defend itself against Russian aggression here. I mean, this war that started last year in February of 2022 was just an outright invasion by Russia of their neighboring country, Ukraine, with an attempt to overthrow the government and reincorporate it into a broader Russian empire, which Putin, I think, has been missing ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Back in 1991. So I think the stakes are incredibly high. If he were to succeed in doing that, then who knows where he would turn next, right? The eastern border of NATO would be then under threat from a renewed aggressive Russian dictatorship that has had enormous success in the face of weakness. So I think standing up to Putin is very important, very much in the Western interests, both the Europeans and the United States. I mean, the question you need to ask yourself is, where do you want to fight Russia? In Ukraine, where do you want to stop them, essentially? Do you want to just let them become as strong as they were back in the Cold War, and so we're fighting them on the German border, or, you know, containing them on the German border? Or do you want to stop them here? So I think it's very much in our interest to stop them where they are. And how we've been helping them? Yes, absolutely. We've been giving them increasingly sophisticated weapons. Key weapons back in the early going were the anti-tank weapons that helped them blunt the Russian offensive. Then we've heard about the HIMARS, the long-range rocket systems that enable them to strike a little bit further behind enemy lines. And we've been helping them with training. We've been helping them with equipping their new armored units that are going to be used in this offensive. So have the British, so have the Germans. They've been using Leopard armored vehicles from Germany, the Challengers from the UK, and they're going to get some Abrams tanks from the United States, Patriot anti-aircraft missile systems, anti-missile systems. So we've been helping them in a myriad of ways. And they've been using that very successfully. I think that's the key difference between this conflict and conflicts in recent memory that the United States was involved in Afghanistan, for instance, and Iraq, whereas in this case, the Ukrainians are eager recipients, eager users and adept users of everything we give them and doing all the fighting themselves, whereas in the previous cases, that was not the case. We would supply and train units, and then they would melt away and desert and collapse and whatnot, and we were dealing with governments and units that were corrupt or less interested in fighting than would have been good for the cause. So in this case, the Ukrainians are doing the fighting, they're doing the dying, and we're helping them defend their country against an outright Russian aggression. So I think it's well worthwhile.
We spoke with you, Andy, on this show about the Russian war in Ukraine almost exactly a year ago when the war was just about 3 months old. A year later, what surprises you about where we are today, and what does that portend for what we can expect next?
I was somewhat favorably surprised by the offenses on the Ukrainian side last fall that regained a fair amount of territory in the north near Kharkiv and in the south, culminating when they recaptured Kherson along the Dnieper River. I thought that boded pretty well in terms of the Ukrainians still weren't that well equipped with Western weapons overall, and yet they were driving the Russians back in important operations. So that was pretty favorably surprising. And I think what the big question is, what's going to happen this summer? An offensive is coming. How successful will it be? Will they really achieve some big strategic success and get to the Sea of Azov? Who knows what could happen? I think if the Ukrainians were able to make some significant gains and take back a bunch of territory and give good promise that they were, worthy recipients of aid and making good use of it, then I think that's all to the good. If they weren't, if the Russians actually turned the tables and started making gains of their own, that would be disappointing. I think it's unlikely, given the enormous investment the Russians made to try to take Bakhmut and the relatively small gains that they made as a result of that. So I think the initiative is all on the Ukrainian side at this point. And so we'll just have to see what happens in the next couple of months.
Andy Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison, who specializes in international relations, armed conflict, and political violence. What do you make of some of the attacks we've seen into the borders of Russia? Although they've been small and they've been few in number, does that surprise you at all?
It's a little bit surprising, but I wouldn't pay too much attention to it. I think it's mostly a kind of a sideshow and a diversion. These are sort of Russian dissidents of one form or another, in some cases far-right neo-Nazi types, who are kind of piggybacking and taking advantage of this conflict to try to work out some of their animosity towards Putin, who kicked them out of Russia earlier, and they sort of circled back and ended up in Ukraine because that was one way they could, get back at Russia or the Russian government, the Putin government. But I don't think they're militarily significant. I don't think they're going to have any serious effect on the tide of war in this case. It's mostly a political theater and kind of a sideshow.
Is there a way to resolve this conflict and find peace with Russia, with Vladimir Putin still in control of Russia?
Yeah, if he's defeated. I mean, I think it's conceivable, and the goal that ought to be pursued is to liberate Ukrainian territory and reestablish the Ukrainian borders as they were before 2014. If that goal is achieved, then I think the war comes to an end. Putin, even if Putin is in power, if he's not in power, that's great. If he is still in power, there won't be much he can do. He could still attack across the border. He could try to launch air raids or whatnot. But I think at that point, the war will be basically over and the Ukrainians will have won. So, what happens to Putin after that? Some people think he can't retain power after such a humiliating defeat. That might be the case, but I think it's of lesser importance to the Ukrainian side.
Andrew Kidd, political science professor at UW-Madison. Still time for you at 1-800-642-1234. And with this situation, all the world's eyes watching the potential for expectations of a counteroffensive. Andy, what are you watching for next?
The big question is, where are they going to strike exactly and how they're going to do it? Are they really going to go for the southern strategy? Are they going to push more northern and eastern in Donetsk. So where the attack is going to happen. And the big question is, can they get through these Russian lines, right? The Russians have been building fortified lines for 6 months to a year now, laying these concrete so-called dragon's teeth, digging anti-tank ditches, laying mines and whatnot. And the question is, are the Ukrainians going to be able to punch through those fortifications and restore mobility? And if they can, then it's kind of all up for the Russians. But if the Russians are able to capably defend those fortified positions, then it could be very slow going. And the Ukrainians will have to pay a lot for the advances that they make.
Andy, I want to thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Kidd is professor of political science, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he specializes in armed conflict, international relations, and political violence. With us today to discuss the latest out of the war in Ukraine and the stakes involved in a counteroffensive against Russia. We want to invite you to continue this conversation and ask your questions or give us your comments at ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Let us know what you know, what you think, and what we can expect next. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Kate Archer Kent gets some perspective on social media from Beloit High School students, as well as a pediatrician who leads the social media and adolescent health research team at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And Kate Archer Kent also talks to the author of On Loneliness, How to Feel Less Alone in an Isolating World. Terry Laxton Brooks explains how loneliness can be a source of growth and provide new opportunities for connections. That's The Morning Show, weekdays from 7 to 9 on the Ideas Network. How green is your ride? On Sunday, a carpenter who built a wooden version of a vintage French car sold it for more than $224,000. The Citroen 2CV is made from apple and pear trees, walnut and cherry wood. While the wooden ride reaches a top speed of 50 miles an hour, it's not street legal, and the cost of any repairs or insurance would be astronomical. Now, consider the Tesla Model Y EV. According to a Reuters analysis of two major salvage companies, the vast majority of Model Ys that were completely scrapped after an accident had traveled less than 10,000 miles. Kelley Blue Book says insurance companies are declaring Teslas totaled after even minor damage because of the incredibly high cost of repairs. CEO Elon Musk is working to lower repair costs and insurance premiums. In the meantime, Tesla is offering its own auto insurance, which, according to its CFO, is now growing faster than its vehicle business. So how green is your ride? This is Central Time.